This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Yes, as my theme clip of music there says, my name is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, and this is episode number 253. It's a great episode. I have two really fantastic and talented women on this particular episode. Just kind of fell together like that. One of them is named Melissa Silverstein, who is pretty well known in the world of journalism. She writes about the film industry and how women fit into that, you know, and she kind of aims a spotlight, if you will, at gender equity in the film business. I wonder if that's a fair way to put it. Anyway, she's a dynamic woman. She's talented, and I had the opportunity to run into her a number of times over the last few months, and we were talking, and she was aware that I do this podcast, and she said, you know, I've been wanting to do one too. So I said, okay, well, how can I help you? And the next thing you know, I'm producing her podcast, and it's called Women and Hollywood. It just launched, finally, just a couple of days ago. So right now, you can go to iTunes, and you can search both FilmWax Radio, and you can leave a nice, you know, a star rating and a nice comment, if you will, and of course, subscribe if you don't already do that. But you also can go and search Women and Hollywood and do the same with Melissa's podcast. She's already had on two segments, and they're both up, and she has a bunch more coming. So I'm very excited to be involved in that. That makes three podcasts that I'm involved with so far, but I feel like it's my mission now, and it's continuing to grow and expand, and it's great. My other guest today is, oh, my lovely pal, Ingrid Veninger. Ingrid, met her a few years ago through a mutual acquaintance. She's my acquaintance, this mutual person, a good friend of Ingrid's. And I was curating my own film series in Brooklyn, and I was always looking for films. And this person says, you know Ingrid Veninger, do you know her films? I said, no, I don't. She goes, well, she's this great Canadian filmmaker, you should look at her films. So I contacted Ingrid. Of course, you find somebody on Facebook. It takes only moments. And I did, and she responded, and she sent me her film Modra, which I subsequently screened in my film series. And I timed it when Ingrid was coming down from Toronto, where she lives, to New York City, because her subsequent film, which is called I Am a Good Person, I'm a Bad Person, was screening at MoMA. So they used to have a series up at MoMA every year called The Canadian Block, and they would showcase a bunch of different, you know, contemporary Canadian filmmakers, and Ingrid had been involved a couple of times. It no longer exists, but she does. So when I was up in Toronto recently for the Toronto International Film Festival, I made it my point to sit with her and to knock one of these podcast segments out, and that's what happened. So she has a more recent film that's come out since, and it's called The Animal Project, and you can see it on Vimeo on demand right now. It's there, and you can check it out. And I happen to know that Ingrid is involved in two more films that are supposedly coming out in the 2015 calendar year. So she's a very prolific person, but she's also really quite a sweetheart, and I'm very delighted just to get her on here. I should also mention that she was just down in New York on Halloween weekend, and her son, her grown son, was in a band, and they were playing in this club in Bushwick, and we got together and got to see that, and that was a lot of fun, too. And they were really talented, so I'm hoping that at some point in the future, I will be able to include some of Jacob's and his band's music on the podcast. Very talented. So that's the show, and we're going to go right into it without any further delay. Here's my brief conversation with Melissa Silverstein, and then we'll come back and introduce the Ingrid segment. Okay, well, so let's turn our attention to the actual thing itself, the podcast, and to also just a little bit of background. Welcome to my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Shoes on the other foot.
Right.
And now you're officially a podcaster. How does that feel?
I'm excited because I think that I will get to talk with all different kinds of people, and we'll get opportunities to hear from folks who are not in the usual kind of rotation of Hollywood type podcasts. And so I'm actually really looking forward to that. And I think for me personally, talking is much easier than writing.
Yes.
So it's going to be, I think, freeing in some way for me to have these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I was grappling when I started, because I also did some writing, not to the extent that you do, but certainly, but I started in terms of my film media work as also writing articles and interviews and blogging and all. And always said to myself, you know, what am I really contributing? You know, like, how am I, I believe you actually are contributing. I just didn't feel like I was. So, you know, as a writer in some way, like, I felt there were so many other writers that I would choose to read over myself. So why would I expect somebody else to read me, you know? So I turned to podcasting sort of accidentally, or in radio, but I found it far more, this is where I'm contributing. And I do find it a lot less painstaking. But anyhow, so I relate to you. But you do come from a writing background. And I was wondering, because I didn't know you that well till more recently, some of that background is and how you arrived at specifically a feminist standpoint in terms of the Hollywood industry.
Well, I think it all goes back to when I was a kid and I was really obsessed with television and theater and
the arts.
And movies. And so part of it for me was that kind of way I looked at the world was through media. And, you know, I vividly remember the day when HBO launched their Saturday night movies because I was still, you know, home on Saturday nights. And, you know, I remember the song that was launched and that we were able to watch a movie. And that was very exciting. I have a story in my book of going to see Yentl for the first time and really understanding what it took for Barbara Streisand to get that movie onto the screen and then researching it and really trying to understand later when the internet was available, kind of really what she gave up for that film.
Can you describe
it? Understanding.
Can you describe Barbara Streisand? Yeah, can you describe briefly what that was? Because I'm just kind of curious as a sidebar.
Yeah, from my understanding, and kind of thought about writing something bigger on Barbara Streisand Yentl, but she was like one of the biggest stars at that time. It was the early 80s. This was a passion project for her. It was about how she connected to her father who died when she was incredibly young. So she was like about 40 then, and she wanted to play this yeshiva boy. And, you know, everyone was like, you're crazy. And it took her an incredibly long time to raise the money. And part of the raising of the money was that if she went over budget, she had to give back half her acting salary. So she went over budget from like minuscule amount. And the budget was, I think it was in the $30 million range, but I don't know, remember off the top of my head, minuscule amount. So she had to like give back part of her salary. And it was received with Golden Globes, but not Oscar nominations, and it did, you know, relatively okay at the box office and disappeared for a long time because it wasn't on DVD. And so you couldn't really see Yentl. And then all of a sudden, in, you know, the last while with DVDs, I mean, I don't even that long ago when she put together the DVD. And, you know, experience of watching Yentl as a person who had discovered Barbara Streisand in high school, the fact that I didn't even know she was a singer when I discovered her. I only discovered her through the movies. And then I discovered her singing, which was, you know, most people's like the opposite, was really profound for me as, you know, young Jewish girl growing up on Long Island. And she was so passionate about her work. And she was one of the first, you know, on one hand, women directors who were directing at the top level of Hollywood, Amy Heckerling, Joan Micklyn Silver, Penelope Spheeris in the early 80s.
Yes.
And so she basically helped launch, you know, women directors. I don't think she's ever gotten her just do. Mm-hmm. Her film, you know, Princess Tides is just a really great, extraordinary film. It's watchable now. It's one of Nick Nolte's best performances. And I think it gets really a short shrift because it's more of a romance. And it's another Pat Conroy novel. And it got nominated for Best Picture. And she did not get nominated. And he got nominated for Best Actor, I believe. So I just feel like her career, she's always been not given enough of a... She's enough credit for what she's done.
Right. I mean, I remember, you know, being a little less focused on this, obviously, probably just because I'm a guy. But I do recall very, very vividly the criticism always focusing on, quote-unquote criticism, always these very snarky remarks about her, things like her nails and, you know, I mean, it's people like to poke fun. But I think in tandem to the fact that they were, as you said, they're not giving her enough credit, it starts to take on a little different shape, you know, this criticism, you know?
Right. And I think, you know, it's a lot of sexist criticism, and to be real. And it was also the fact that there was... Mm-hmm. You okay?
Yeah, I just dropped a spoon.
It's also the fact that there were just so few women at that time. So the context was always in relationship to her gender. And this is what happens when there are so few women, is that you get held up to a higher standard. And Barbara Streisand has always been ahead of the game, so she's always been held to a higher standard. And I think that's why she hasn't directed as much. And she hasn't been able to raise money in the way that her male peers have been. Mm-hmm. The success rate she has, it's a crime that she hasn't directed more movies.
But so that was a, sounds like a significant moment.
Yeah, it was one of the, you know, when you saw all the credits on the screen at the end and saw all the different things that she did, it was like one of those moments where I was like, okay, this is something I haven't noticed before and something that I need to take note of. And then I spent a lot of time, worked in the theater business for a while, and then I worked in women's organizations, but I always was person who was the pop culture person. Even I was working in feminist organizations and about empowering women, but I always thought about how to use pop culture to reach people. And as time went on, I discovered the blogosphere and the fact that there was very few people writing about women. Mm-hmm. Women in Hollywood is now 7 years old from its first incarnation. And it took a while to figure out what women in Hollywood could be and should be, and it's still always an evolving project.
That you were always leading the charge with pop culture in whatever feminist organizations you were working in. Then you started the blog. How did it end up on IndieWire? How did you manage that, or did they approach you? Or
I mean, it was all because of Ann Thompson, and we had connected, and she was helping IndieWire expand its blogs, and Shadow and Act and Playlist came in at the same time as I did, around the same time, and I joined IndieWire. I think it's going to be 4 years soon, and it's been a great place for the blog because it gives us credibility and visibility in the film community and access for people to find us. And I couldn't be happier.
How often do you contribute to the blog?
Well, there is a writer who works with me, a news editor. Her name is Ingu Kang, and she and I work every day, and we put 4 or 5 pieces up every day. They include interviews and news posts, and we really try to be as current as possible. But we also feel that it's important not to just repeat what everybody is writing. If you read the blogosphere, there's like a circle of stories, and everybody covers mm-hmm. the thing. And I feel that that's important in certain instances, but other times other people are saying it and we don't need to repeat it. So we're going to look for things that are a bit different that other people are not going to cover. So for example, one of the things that we do is an interview series with women directors at major film festivals. And they answer a certain amount of questions, and we roll those out across the festival, and we've been told that people use them from all across the world to help with programming. So we provide a service, and we really try to also make people in the business aware of the lack of opportunities for women directors, but also where there are opportunities to highlight them and to be a voice for women across the entertainment sector to put their work out there as much as possible, and also for the consumers who are looking for content that has women. Mm-hmm. There are so few films. 30% of characters in films in 2013 were women. Only 15% of the top 100 grossing films had a female protagonist. We're 50% of the population. We need to be seen. Our stories are as important. And that's what Women in Hollywood focuses on. We advocate, we educate, and we agitate for gender parity, gender diversity in the entertainment business.
Well said. And do you pay attention to the Bechdel test? It seems like it's being employed more. For instance, I know Fandor now employs it. Do you think a step in the right direction?
I mean, I think the Bechdel test is a really rudimentary tool for analyzing gender. But because we have such a gap in gender in film, that it's become a place where people can actually latch on to the conversation. My whole point about the Bechdel test, and I've said this to everyone who supports the Bechdel test, it has nothing to do with content.
Okay.
So it can be two women talking to each other or about something other than a man, and they could be shooting each other. And that would pass the Bechdel test.
I see. So it's not contextual. That right.
Exactly. Okay. So we need to keep the Bechdel test in context. What is important for us to note is the fact that movies that pass the Bechdel test have less of a budget than movies that don't pass the Bechdel test. So basically, movies with women as primary characters get less money. But on the return, movies that pass the Bechdel test make more money
mm-hmm.
for their budgets. So it pays to employ women on screen. We just need to get people to believe in that a bit more.
So now you have indeed moved on to doing a podcast. And again, as your blog is called, it is called Women and Hollywood. And you've already have two episodes in the bag, one with Jill Pantozzi.
Yes.
And
Jill Pantozzi is the editor-in-chief of the Mary Sue, which is a geek girl blog, and I really wanted to talk with her because we had a lot of news last week on the superheroine front.
Right.
And so that we dive into that, and also we talk about Gamergate. And then also the other interview up is Katie Chevenier. She's the co-director of E-Team, which is now streaming on Netflix, and it's a fantastic movie about Human Rights Watch activists who go into the hot spots in the world to document human rights abuses. And it's a fascinating look at these people who are just really trying to help and save humanity.
The focus is specifically on Libya and Syria, a couple of hot spots at the moment. And
It's also about kind of like how you take information back and get it out to the world, and how important that piece it is to be on the ground to report these things.
And having somebody in neutral organization with credibility is
absolutely
is a rarity. And that's one thing that they really, really are always hyper aware of and diligent about.
And I wanted to add, some people ask me, you know, why is your blog called Women in Hollywood? And I think what I really always try to say to people, it's called Women in Hollywood because Hollywood is everywhere. 70 cents of every dollar is of the Hollywood movies are made overseas. Our TV shows are everywhere. So Hollywood is everywhere. So this is about women and entertainment. This is about the all-encompassing conversation about Hollywood and how it affects the world and how women are not enough of the leaders and enough of the visible participants in the conversation.
By way of disclaimer, I produced I've been producing the podcast, but it's been a real pleasure to listen to your shows and to become more familiar with you're doing God's work, Melissa.
The goddess's
work, excuse me.
Thank you for saying that, but I really feel that, you know, it shouldn't be. I mean, maybe one day I won't have a job anymore because we'll be completely, integrated. I think we have about a generation to go, two to go until people really kind of understand the power of women, mm-hmm. the power of women at the box office, the power of women's stories. And all these things are mixed up in our world. This is not, Hollywood is not just like a standalone entity. We live in a world where, you know, women are still not treated in equal positions. And so this is just a reflection of the work that we have to do for women all across the world. And that's my phone ringing. Hold on one sec. Can you hold on one second? Okay, so are we good?
Yes, thanks a lot. And yes, that's great. So
you got it. Thanks, right. Adam.
You bet.
Bye.
By the way, you can visit Melissa's website. She's part of the series of IndieWire blogs that they have. You can go to blogs.indiewire.com/womenandhollywood and find this great blog that she contributes to. So, Ingrid, again, Ingrid doesn't have any films coming out, any moment in the near future, but later in 2015 she will, and I'm sure we'll bring her back on for that. But this is Ingrid's first time on FilmWax Radio, and I'm thrilled about it. So we were sitting up at during TIFF, we sat together. You'll hear quite a few people in the background just milling about because, or as they say in Toronto, milling about because we were in a kind of an open space, but it was great. It was still a very great conversation. So here it is, my conversation with Ingrid Veninger.
These red microphones.
I know, right? It's like clown noses, right?
Yeah, like big clown noses in my mouth.
Mm-hmm. I
it's a big clown
that.
Nose in my mouth.
Nothing better than that.
I don't know.
So I'm getting nervous and jittery and... So...
Are you going to set up our environment?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So here we are, where we are, day, time, like time, place.
You can do it. You really sound good on here. It's 1:48 in the afternoon. We are in the city of Toronto, Ontario. And we're in the Hyatt Hotel on King Street West, right?
Yeah.
We're in the midst of the final days of the Toronto International Film Festival, and I am finally speaking with a very coveted interview here. I've been finally speaking with Ingrid Veninger. Veninger. I think you have to...
Veningorova, actually.
Oh, wait, right. You're Czech, right?
Yeah, I'm Slovak.
You're Slovak.
Yeah, different.
Pardon me. Right.
But...
Yes, it's good to be learned.
We were once united with the Czech people.
I remember that.
Yeah.
My visit, my one and only visit to the Czech Republic, obviously, was as after that split. But not that long after.
No.
It was like in the city was very beautiful, but in the definitely in the beginning throes of a lot of development going on there. A lot of... construction, I noticed when I was there.
But you've never been to Bratislava? You didn't come over to the Slovak side?
No, I didn't have a...
too bad.
No, it is too bad.
Yeah.
But I'm a very young person, and I have years ahead of me.
I was going to say a bucket list item, but we're not there yet. We're not making our bucket list yet.
That doesn't
have
to be a priority yet.
We're just doing whatever we want.
I saw some posting of a kid who like got to... perform on some reality show or one of the, you know, where they sing or something. And it was like off the bucket list. And like a kid with a bucket list, that's not appropriate. Your life is an empty bucket.
Exactly. It's an empty bucket.
Seriously though, it is so nice finally to be able to do this interview, you know, because you and I met, it's going to guess 2 years ago, maybe a little bit, slightly more than that.
2011.
So 3 years ago, mm-hmm. you have a good, but you can associate it with that screening of I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, right, at MoMA. And as you mentioned to me yesterday, Chris Lefko, a mutual, an acquaintance of mine, but a friend of yours, introduced us, I guess, and then...
Yeah, she's an awesome rock and roller.
Yeah.
She introduced us, and then we met in person in New York.
Yeah, but I saw, but I watched MoDRA
You
first,
did.
And then I reached out because I was like, oh, this is wonderful. This is yeah. a great film.
And that was our New York premiere. The Film Wax screening was wow. our New York premiere of MoDRA.
I hope I did it. I you know, in my heart, I did as much. I did it.
No,
as
it was fantastic.
As,
yeah, it was at Freddy's in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and I remember it being really fun. And then we went out for pizza, and the co-star of MoDRA, Alexander Gamal, came down. It was his first right. time to New York, mm-hmm. so it's all very exciting.
It was. No, and it really was really nice to meet you and to see the film. And then, on top of that, I got to go to see, I went to MoMA to see I'm a Good Person, I'm a Good, and I was, again, completely impressed with your filmmaking.
That was a really cool audience because I think Clark Johnson was in New York at the time. He was, of course, been on The Wire and Homicide, Life on the Street, and I worked with him on three feature films, the latest being Nurse Fighter Boy, which he was the star of. He played the fighter. So Clark Johnson was there. Jeremy Padeswa was there. Carol Pope was there. Mm-hmm. Did you know you were at a star-studded screening at MoMA?
Was I at the same one, though?
Yes,
were
you
two.
Were, because okay. I have a picture of you. We all
oh, you
we
do.
Took a
right.
picture.
Yes, of course.
And that,
I do
there was
that.
Clark and Jeremy and Carol
yes.
Pope.
Now I do remember that. I do remember. I was standing yeah. there with people that... that yes, everybody was like right. I remember you're right in the lobby.
Exactly.
Everybody was sort of circling you, like you know you and then we all did a photo. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and that's too bad because Telefilm screen. Canada partnered with MoMA, and
yes.
10 films would be presented every year mm-hmm. in March, mm-hmm. and then they after the 10th year they stopped doing it. Well, I think Larry Kardish left,
right,
and then it sort of all stopped.
I see. Well, we need to pick up the gauntlet, and I'm going to restart the Canadian block.
Whoa, that would be so good.
Yeah. No, because, I mean, you know, not that I saw, but one thing I didn't see much, I mean, at that series. But having said that, it's interesting because we all know, I mean, the Americans, the people that live in the States, and possibly Europeans, I can't speak for them, they know Canada for a particular number of filmmakers, you know.
Mostly Quebecois filmmakers, probably.
Well, is David Cronenberg Quebec?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, he's not. Most
okay.
of most people do consider him American, though. I don't know why. But when
American?
When I tell Americans that David Cronenberg is Canadian, mm-hmm. they don't believe me.
Hmm. Well, this is actually confirming what I was kind of trying to say, which is that Americans, they don't really know the Canadian filmmakers that much. And so when there is somebody big and who gets wide distribution in the States like Cronenberg, they do assume that. And of course, we look and sound pretty similar most of the time.
Yeah, we do,
unless
eh?
Yeah. About the same. About the same. But having been coming to Toronto for about 20 years myself, I've gotten to know a few, but...
No, I know, and that's why it was great exposure for us
yeah,
because
right.
for many of us it was our American premiere. We got a great place to showcase the work. We'd get a bit of press
mm-hmm.
and some interesting, I wouldn't know, I don't know if sales, but certainly some interesting press and maybe some small theatricals came out of mm-hmm. that MoMA showcase.
Mm-hmm. Right. No,
so it was a really good thing. And yeah. I met new people, and it was a trip to New York every year.
Right. So how many times? You were there
I was there 3 times.
Really?
Once for Nurse Fighter Boy, for my first feature film, Nurse Fighter Boy.
Nurse Fighter Boy. Was that a short film? Or
feature film.
How many features have you made? And then go back to that.
Well, I've written, directed, and produced 4.
Okay.
So out of the 4, I've made only screened at MoMA, and I'm a Good Person, I'm a Bad Person screened at MoMA. And Nurse Fighter Boy was a feature film that I co-wrote and produced. Mm-hmm. And it was out of the Canadian Film Center. The director was Charles Officer.
Okay. What is the film, the Canadian Film Center? Is that what you
The said? Canadian Film Center was founded by Norman Jewison.
Is that right? Was he Canadian?
Yes.
Okay. See, I just got schooled again.
Yes. And
but he did live down here. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he...
Hollywood.
He founded the school that basically has residents of 5 writers, 5 directors, 5 producers. They've just started a composer residency program, an actor's conservatory, And I come and do some guest workshops there every year. And it's they really turn out some amazing filmmakers every year. And I think they've been around for 25 years.
Right. By the way, another that is impressive. Canadian.
I might be wrong on that. Can we look it up? Can you Google how long the Canadian Film Center has been around?
All right. I was about to bring up the fact that another recent guest of mine is from Toronto. And also probably widely claimed by Americans as one of their own, Paul Haggis.
Oh, Paul Haggis.
Yeah.
Crash. It's funny because when we make our films, we have to do these title searches. And it's typically very hard to get insurance if you have the same title as another film. And it was so interesting to me that he called this film Crash after Cronenberg's Crash.
Right.
And so whenever we speak of Crash,
we
have to basically say, are you talking about Haggis's Crash or Cronenberg's Crash?
Right. So can I ask why is the insurance part the hard part? What? Because people will screw up and they'll identify the wrong film, and that will affect
that's definitely on the marketing side, but for the insurance purposes, it's to protect the broadcaster and the distributor from any lawsuits where maybe the first film that claimed that title might come after the second film.
So I see. See, again, you're just a font of great information, because that's something that anyone listening might...
Yeah, so if you're going to make a film, go on IMDb and make sure there's no other film with that title.
Right.
If you're making a feature and there's a short film with that title, it's, you know, it could be okay, but I'd say avoid the whole thing altogether.
Right. As a matter of fact, here's an interesting case where another recent guest and friend of mine, Dan Schechter, who has a brand new film called Life of Crime, who was adapted from an Elmore Leonard novel, and who was given approval and permission to go ahead, and he wrote the script on spec and then sent it to Elmore Leonard, who approved it and gave him his,
I have an Elmore Leonard story.
We'll get to it. But so the thing is that Elmore, he said, yes, it's fantastic. It was The Switch is the name of the book that it was adapted for. Now, the problem wasn't, I think there might have been a version of The Switch, I may be wrong, but the problem wasn't calling it The Switch. The problem was that Jennifer Aniston who is the star, had done a film earlier in her career called The Switch. So it was, she couldn't do another movie called The Switch. So he changed it to Life of Crime, which, you know, arguably is okay a name, but a very good film as it turns out, and she was excellent in it. But that's just an interesting. And then David.
It's just my daughter's calling.
Oh, no.
Responsible parent.
We can edit and stop and all that. And it's not live.
So
you would
switch.
Have never done that on NPR. My daughter, I don't give a shit. I don't have children. Go ahead.
No, Ruth, certainly my character, and I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, wouldn't have answered the phone.
And that was your daughter.
Yeah.
In the movie, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Go see I Am a Good Person, I Am a Bad Person. But we're going to come out into ways maybe people can find these films.
Maybe it'll be on Fandor.
Good to put that out there. I think it will be. I hope so. I think you guys will have a good... Yeah, I think it is a good match in this case. And you should check it out. And you can get like a... if you become a fan or a filmmaker, I'm sure they provide you with a login and all that. But you can get a 2-week trial subscription.
Oh, that'd be great.
I'm not here to hawk.
No, but I'm going to try to get I'm a Good Person, I'm a Bad Person out there.
You
need Fandor
to.
Might be
so
a good,
good.
Place to
it
start.
Is a really, yeah, no, it's a terrific place. And I think it really would find a home because of the people that would visit, that would go there and subscribe are your audience.
Who is my
Netflix
audience?
Doesn't have an audience.
Well, because I'm always asked who I think my audience is. Who do you think my audience is?
I'll tell you who they aren't. I'm kidding. I love just
well,
saying
I know that.
No, but they are people that just like personal films. I mean, you're telling stories that it's character-driven, story-driven, personal films. You know, you're in great company. And those used to be mainstream films, too, by the way. They just happen not to be so much anymore, you know, because unless you're making your film with no dialogue, so it plays in China. Are you going to do that? Probably not anytime soon.
No, probably not.
No, but so the nice thing about a company like, and again, I'm not here to hawk Fandor, but is that it really, those who subscribe are going to be the choir.
Yeah.
You know, and it may be, maybe you could say, well, then those who could be brought over to the choir but just aren't used to watching those kinds of films, that's their problem with getting those people, whereas Netflix just gets kind of the crowd, everybody, right?
Yeah. No, well, it's been a cool time, I think, for us as independent filmmakers because the last film, The Animal Project, right, we started talking about this.
I did want to hear more about that film because I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Well, you can watch it on Vimeo, VOD,
oh,
everywhere in the world. Okay. And in Canada, it's available on iTunes. So I had the Animal Project here at TIFF last year, 2013. I had secured Mongrel Media as a distributor. I knew that I wanted to do a day and date, which means that I wanted to do my theatrical release on this, and on the same day release on VOD worldwide. And because I knew that was going to happen in June, essentially June 6th, I was able to let everyone know at every single festival screening I attended, mm-hmm, because inevitably there is a question in the Q&A, where can I see this film after this festival run? I could say on June 6th, 2014, it'll be available whether I was at a festival in Australia or in Denver, right, or yes, anywhere else. I could say it was available. That's the first time I've been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of exciting.
Right, of course. Yeah, yeah. So that's the Vimeo?
Yeah,
on
Vimeo
demand.
On demand. And then Mongrel made the deal with iTunes. And the Vimeo on demand deal is cool because last year at TIFF, Cameron Bailey had co-signed a letter because they were looking to find 10 world premieres. Mm-hmm. So they handpicked 10 world premieres, and they were offering a $10,000 advance.
Wow.
So those of us that stepped up got $10,000, and once Vimeo recoups that $10,000, the split is 90%,
right,
of
yes,
every rental and sale goes to the filmmaker, and 10% right, goes to Vimeo.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is better than the iTunes split, which yeah, is 70-30.
Jeremy Boxer was, do you know Jeremy? He's
Jeremy, yeah.
Yeah, he was on the show, and he told me about that.
Exactly.
It's a great deal for filmmakers.
Yeah, Jeremy's my point person. He was the one that sort of launched the whole Spotlight on TIFF thing.
Yes, right. Yeah, I saw him the other day. He's here, or he was here. And,
mm-hmm. Good person.
Yeah, and not a bad person. which film is it that's on
The Animal Project.
The Animal Project.
So that's the latest.
Right. And that, when did that come out here?
Theatrical was June 6th, 2014, so just this past summer.
Oh, okay.
And it was a cool one because, as you know, my past films have involved my family.
Mm-hmm.
So my first feature only was written for my son, my second for my daughter, which is called Modra. My third, I'm a Good Person, I'm a Bad Person, was with my daughter and myself. And the Animal Project really was inspired by my wanting to work with professional actors that I'd never worked with before that I didn't know.
Hmm.
And the challenge for me was to cast my actors first, hmm, and then come up with a story for the film.
What? Is that true?
Yes, it's
now,
true.
What went to that decision? What went into that decision?
I think I really needed people that were going to do something really ridiculous and take a huge leap of faith in that they committed to work with me for 3 months before knowing anything about the roles they were going to play. I wanted those kind of people.
Right. It sounds terribly collaborative because you went with creating a team before a story.
It's interesting if you spoke to them. I don't know. I think people think working with me is quite collaborative, but I don't know how collaborative it really is, in the sense that I always write a script and I'm giving my actors roles to play. And then when I'm making my films, I think I like there to be some flexibility. It's why my crew is mostly just one cameraman and one sound recordist. Essentially, my crew is two people, maybe up to four or five people is my entire production crew. And that affords me some flexibility, but it's a really, it's a controlled kind of chaos.
Mm-hmm. It was just that since you hire these people, I thought maybe you workshop something and then, but no.
Yeah, no, okay. No workshops. I selected 8 actors and promised them roles at the end of November, mm-hmm, 2012. And then I promised that we would start shooting in March of 2013. So I had December, January, and February to write the script, mm-hmm, and get all the locations and organize the shoot and get the crew and everything. So my first month of writing, December, was a nightmare. I basically could not come up with an idea.
Mm.
No workshopping, no rehearsing. I visited their homes. They let me shoot in their homes. I looked at where they worked. So those locations started to form some of the locations in the final film because they were cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, December was a write-off, and then the pressure was really on in January. And I got to page 30 of the script about 10 times, and then I would abandon. And I wrote the full screenplay, which ended up being like 110 pages, 130 scenes, in the first 4 days of February. Mm-hmm. gave all my actors the script, got into furious prep for the last 3 weeks of February, and on March 3rd we were shooting. So the first time my eight actors met one another was on the first day of shooting, which is the first scene in the film. That was the first time they all met.
Mm-hmm. How'd it come out?
I like it. Mm-hmm. I like this film a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, it sort of asks the question, why bother making anything? And I think to ask that question, I needed people to sort of, take a big leap. And I came out the other side just feeling, I guess, inspired by process, mm-hmm. and inspired by just the doing of it.
Right.
Just the making of it.
Yes. Well, yeah, and then you seem to set up an all-new dynamic for yourself by not using family again, and that you wanted to challenge yourself artistically, and also by casting before you had the story.
Yeah. And I paid for the production myself again, not because, and out of choice in that I just finished the script in February and I had to be shooting by March. Mm-hmm. And I gave myself time. You know, you always say in low budget or independent filmmaking, you have to choose two of these three, good, fast, cheap. Mm-hmm. You can't have all three.
Right. I've heard that expression.
So
I think actually Alex Karpovsky talked about, used that expression.
I think you can have all three. I think you can have all three, but you have to be incredibly organized, and you have to make sure that your vision is aligned with the limitations of how much time and how much money you have. That's why you see a lot of low-budget films in a cabin or in a room, or if you have too many locations, it becomes difficult. But I gave The Animal Project a 36-day shooting schedule.
Which is not ungenerous by today's standards.
That's a lot of days.
Right.
Yeah. And I shot 3 days each week. Mm-hmm. So 3 days each week was spent shooting Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And then the other 4 days was spent editing and prepping. So my cast and crew...
So you were editing as you went. Yeah.
Editing as we were going. So my cast and crew could make money, a lot of money on those other days, booking themselves out on, you know, commercials and whatever. They could organize their lives around those three shooting days. We shot until the end of May. Mm-hmm. I basically had a cut by the end of June. I submitted it to TIFF, and so we were in world premiering in September. So from finishing the script in February to world premiering in September, 7 months.
Yeah.
That's fast.
Yeah. I just wonder if you figured out a certain formula there that you can... It certainly sounds like it works for you.
Yeah, I don't think I would ever do that again.
I understand.
In the sense that I think it really makes a lot of sense to write a script... And
right.
then cast the actors.
Sure, yeah.
This other way of promising actors roles and then writing the script was... I'm glad I did it once. I don't think The Animal Project would exist the way it does if I'd done it the traditional way, which is really actually cool to look at how the process really affects the result.
Mm-hmm. And again, so it's available on Vimeo.
Yeah, Vimeo VOD, The Animal Project.
Right. Okay, so folks should check that out.
The easiest way to do it is maybe go to my company's Punk Films and just go to punkfilms.ca and then you can check out the trailer and then there's a link right there to rent or buy.
That's perfect. Let's step back now that we're sort of caught up. I mean, I know you have new projects you're about to begin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
You have a new I do.
Okay, that's good. But where are you from?
I was born in Bratislava. Mm-hmm. And we emigrated in 1968 as the Russian tanks were coming in. My mother carried me in her arms and we left. And my parents did not know how to speak English. My father was an architect in Bratislava and my mother was a school teacher. Mm-hmm. And so when we came to Canada, my father started to work in construction and my mother was a house cleaner. Mm-hmm. And they've reinvented themselves so many times. They are my heroes of fearlessness and reinvention. Right. They were never afraid to start from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Did your father, is it that he was a professional, and then he came here and he kind of had to start, maybe not from scratch, but not much beyond that, right?
Pretty much from scratch,
right? I mean, did his employers, did his employers... recognize his talents and that was he given a little bit of a leg up that way?
I mean, it's so tough, right? And the people that you think might help you end up stabbing you in the back because they're just trying to get ahead themselves. And it was a long road, you know? And my parents, my dad especially, still has a very thick accent. People make all kinds of assumptions about him.
Absolutely.
But, you know, my mother, after being a house cleaner, started working in various kitchens as a chef's assistant and then sous chef. And then she started to move into children's services, and she started to work at daycares, and then she became a daycare supervisor. And then I started to work in television, and my mom and dad were interested in opening a cafe together. And then my mom started working in craft service, which is, you know, a very important position because it's the person that feeds the cast and crew.
Absolutely.
24/7 pretty much. So my mom started working in craft service on big shows. She always made, what was it, Bill Shatner always wanted something to do with blueberries. I think it was like blueberry and granola. Always she had a bowl of blueberries, fresh blueberries.
Individually. Who is this Bill Shatner fella, by the way?
He's Canadian.
George Takei. Did you see that? There's a new documentary.
I haven't, but I heard wonderful things.
And Bill Shatner's in it.
Right.
Strange guy.
No, my mom never fed him, but Bill Shatner on Tech War. She did a bunch of series, and then she became my favorite craft person because people would know she's my mom, and typically people always complain about the food, but they never complained on my sets.
No.
Because my mom hustled.
Right. That's great. And so where are they now?
My mom is a Zumba instructor.
Oh, well, she keeps moving along, doesn't she?
She goes to all these fitness conferences, and she teaches Zumba 5 days a week.
Okay.
And my dad has a little gallery. He's a framer in Collingwood near Wasega Beach. So they've had 50 different careers.
Right, and they don't seem to want to retire.
No. I think my dad would like to slow down a little bit. My mom, no.
The framing? Is it real pressure?
Yeah, framing.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like it's a nice kind of, you know, retirement-friendly direction to go, though, because framing, there's probably not tons of pressure. I'm guessing.
No, it's quite meditative. He makes his own hours. He's got
it's a
little
craft.
Yeah.
It's nice, right?
Yeah.
No, that's great. And you have siblings, or?
Well, that's a funny question. I consider myself to be an only child, but I do have a half-sister.
Your sister and brothers don't.
No, but I only found out. Yeah, I only found out. I only knew she was in the world when I turned 18.
Okay.
So, do you want to hear the story?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try to make it short. So I didn't know I had a sister. I did know my dad was married previous to meeting my mom. But I used to teach dance lessons at the YMCA. I was a dancer before I was an actor. And my dad had an ice cream shop. Mm-hmm. And so there were these posters for my dance lessons on his ice cream shop. And my sister used to frequent this ice cream shop because she went to OCAD across the street. And so she would buy ice cream from him every day. And then, you know, pretty much every day. And so she noticed these posters and my name, Ingrid Veninger, was on there. And she said, oh, so do you know Ingrid Veninger? And he said, yeah, she's my daughter. And of course, her name is Adrian Veninger. So I don't think she then and there said, I'm your daughter too. But pretty much a week after, she approached and bought ice cream and said, I think I'm your daughter too. And he had no idea she was in Toronto. And so then they had to tell me about her.
So wait, you're leaving out though some of the backstory because your dad had a past relationship back home in Bratislava.
Yes.
Bratislava.
Yes.
And had a child. Did he know about it?
That
is his okay.
Of
but
course.
But they split up.
They split up.
And he, you know, like I guess you know, in this, it's not contemporary times where it's not unusual for after a marriage or a relationship goes wrong that the mother would keep the baby, right?
Yes.
And the guy it's much more of a contemporary idea that the guy would stay in the life of this child necessarily. Usually it's not so
well. There's
been that way,
there's
ex so
like he had been
clear,
in prison, you know. So when the Russians were coming back in 68, he was either going to go back into prison or he had to leave.
Oh, okay.
So
not,
there were
not much of a commie.
There were other
Okay.
There were other circumstances for him needing to leave.
I see.
But he left.
Right.
With my mother and me. I was
she
very
kept
little.
The name, though, for her daughter.
Yes.
So they were married then.
They were married.
And then she.
And so they stayed there.
Right.
As far as he knew, they stayed there.
And then she emigrated to the same city. Did
yes.
she know that her father might be there?
The daughter didn't know. Of course, the mother knew, but had no interest to connect them.
Okay. That's crazy
yeah.
story. So and you didn't know.
No,
your,
I didn't
know.
Your
father never shared that with you. That he had no. Was he ashamed of it, or was it just even not even that much?
I think it was.
It was just then. It was then. That was
I
something
think
else.
So there was so much that was then.
Yeah, right.
There was so much that was
right.
then.
This is a new start, and I'm not going. I'm not thinking back. That was the because he dealt in life and death.
Yeah.
Know, right. New chapters and all that. This yeah. is like. Serious thing.
It's different kind of level of survival
yeah,
and
right.
what you
I
have
understand.
To do to survive.
Right. Yeah. No, I get it. That's yeah. why one should never judge.
No, there's so many layers and it's so complicated. And he would be a really interesting interview for you because, mm-hmm. you know, it's...
Don't tell me there was a film career in there too.
No, there
between
was
the framing and the ice cream shop. He was a made a...
No, but the funny thing is she's an amazing photographer and painter mm-hmm. and she's... Her partner is a composer, and we kind of circulate in the same world. But,
this is your sister.
Yeah, but really after we met, and we and, you know, I really care about her a lot, but she pretty much wrote me a letter and said we can't really be friends.
Oh.
Because I ended up having a dad my whole life, and
I
she
see.
Didn't.
It just brought up too much pain for
so
her,
it's just,
that relationship. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sucks.
But the punchline of it all, maybe, mm-hmm. is that she lives about 10 minutes away from my parents in Collingwood. She ended up moving to Collingwood with her partner. They live like 10, very, so
and
close.
And your dad isn't interested in trying to work
well, it. It's a two-way thing, you know?
It is two-way, but, you know...
You can't
but
impose your...
No, but he's got... But he really... I mean, for it to work, he would probably have to get the door slammed in his face and still come back... You know, for a long time to make that happen. It would be the sort of the onus is on him in that way, you know, because he's the father, right? But, you know, again, I'm not judging. I'm just saying
yeah.
that's probably what would have to happen. That's quite a story. Yeah, that's too bad that...
But she's incredible and she's mm-hmm. doing well. So when you ask me, that's like,
yeah,
wow.
I understand.
I could have answered that. I could have just said, I'm an only child.
Right. Well, thank you for... Well, in case she's listening, I hope she...
Yeah.
But thank you for sharing that. Personal mm-hmm. story, and then, but when did you find film? You said you came from dance,
yeah.
So that happened first.
Dance happened first, and out of dance, I got an agent when I was 11, and then I
11.
Started. Yeah,
you must have been good.
And then I started acting.
Oh, okay. The agent
yeah.
was the agent kind of think you're smart, and you know, obviously, just he could see that you had the potential for that?
Well, it was weird. I've never been the kind of person that stands out in a crowd. No, it's true.
Okay.
I have these dreadlocks and maybe, you know.
Skeptical expression
no.
for a moment there because she stands out.
No, I've never been the kind of person that stands out a crowd, but mm-hmm. I've always been the kind of person, well, I can remember, you know, being in elementary school. If someone dares me to do something, I like a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would take people up on kind of ridiculous dares. And I was never really afraid to be a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing stuff, mm-hmm. I ended up standing out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Always by doing stuff. I couldn't just sit there and not do anything and have anybody be interested. But I would do stuff. And so in dance class, I would not do things the way everyone else was doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Or so I ended up getting these little solos or these little moments. And I would put my own little kind of stamp on things. And that's how I got an agent. So an agent said, you know, you might be good for commercials because mm-hmm. you've got that little
right.
thing that's kind of different from right. other people.
Little twinkle.
Yeah.
And were you, was this modern contemporary dance or, right? This was...
It was jazz, tap,
okay.
ballet,
okay.
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
the
we would
gamut.
Have these recitals, you know?
Yeah.
Marianne
from Film Society.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Oh, I'd like to say hi to her. Yeah, I'd like to say hi to her. I remember having dinner with her. We screened at the Lincoln Center a short film that I made with Charles Officer, again, of Nurse Fighter Boy, screened at the New York Film Festival
mm-hmm.
and opened for Distant, mm-hmm. Nuri's film Distant, that
oh,
I think
yes,
had just won
that.
The Palme d'Or.
Amazing movie.
Yeah.
He's,
so that was very cool.
Yeah, that's. Have you seen Winter Sleeps?
Sleep. No, but I'd
yeah.
I am
well.
Going to see it on Sunday night.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay. I unfortunately won't be able to see it here. And I just don't have the time. And also, it's oddly not at the New York Film Festival. It's like definitely like an odd exception because they seem to have gotten everything else.
And
he was so perfect for. I think they played most of his other films.
And he's so nice. He's so generous. So, anyways, commercials. And then my first sort of dramatic role was when I was 12 on CBC. Do you know Al Waxman? also a famous Canadian. He was on a TV show. He's passed away, but he was on a TV show called The King of Kensington. Mm-hmm. He was the king. And anyway, he gave me my first acting job.
Wow.
When I was 12, I played a pregnant teen.
Mm-hmm. Was it a kind of like a very gritty?
It was a hybrid, actually. It was sort of, CBC used to do these things called For the Record, where they would dramatize real life events, and then there would be this discussion about them. So I was playing a teen in her, I think, second trimester of pregnancy. So the issue of to have an abortion or not have an abortion was a very, very tricky one for everyone involved.
Right.
And so there would be these dramatizations, and then, you know, professionals would speak about the story. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing about that is, because it was my first thing, I had to cry. I had these very dramatic scenes. And I didn't understand that I would have to cry 25 times because the camera would have, maybe the scene would have five different setups. So there'd be a master shot, and there would be a two shot of me and the doctor, and another two shot of me and my mom. And then there would be some, you know, a couple of singles, two different sizes or whatever. And so I think my close-up was the last shot of the day.
Yeah, they do that.
And I had cried 25 times already by the time they got to my shot. I didn't.
Yeah.
And, of course, Ken Welsh, also another Canadian, used to say to me, out of the frame, never out of the game. Mm-hmm. So just because the camera's on you doesn't mean you sit back. Mm-hmm. So I cried and I cried. And by the time they got to me, I had absolutely nothing left. I was so dry. Mm-hmm. That I was just crying because I wanted it to be over.
Right. Oh, so you did.
I did cry.
I was going to say, that's when the dog dies. The pet dog is dead. You know, that's when the...
Yeah, the goldfish and the dog, all that. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, because I was going to say, you know, I can't remember who was on that talked about specifically that. I'm not sure if this was on some other interview or my show, because I've done so many, but that they tried to change that whole idea, like get the close-up shots right away, like, you know, when it's cause for that emotion, because you can't. It's like,
well, especially with young actors,
right?
The children,
but anybody, it's like, right. Why would you, wait to the end to do those?
Because sometimes people, every actor is different, but sometimes actors hit their stride on take 7 or 11. So you get wide stuff done first, and then you come in, and they're just relaxed, and they're freer and looser.
And they're clicked into this groove of whatever the scene requires.
And they're in that effortless mode of just doing it without thinking so much.
Right.
And you get the great stuff.
Good stuff, yeah. So from there, though, you grew up. And then when did you decide you wanted to be a filmmaker? Did you go
there was a bunch of acting. I started getting a little typecast as the rebel or the best friend that was a bad influence.
Did you do any movies? Did you do any work in the States? Or?
I didn't really do any work in the States, but I worked with some amazing people. I worked with Meryl Streep, who was super fun. Yeah, she's sort of underground.
Yeah. What project was that?
It was called First Do No Harm. It was a TV movie. There were a lot of TV movies. I think this was like in the late 80s.
Oh, okay.
And I worked with Holly Hunter on...
I saw her earlier today in Manglehorn.
I would have loved to have seen her on Harlan County.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you ever see that with Stellan Skarsgård and Holly Hunter?
Harlan County. I don't know that I...
Whose idea it was to make the fiction version
Barbara
of
Barbara Coppola
the,
was on too. But,
Barbara Coppola. Amazing.
She did my show. But no, I didn't. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it was...
But it makes sense to do that.
Yeah. I liked working with Stellan Skarsgård very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really asked, I was mentioning this other day, Holly Hunter is the only person that after working with her, I asked her for her autograph.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I hadn't, because we were working together. We were doing scenes together. And then, you know, it was the end of working together, and I just admired her so much. Mm-hmm. And Raising Arizona is one of my favorite films. And So I asked for her autograph, and then I could just see this thing go over her eyes, like, okay. And then it sort of became, as opposed to us becoming maybe friends, I've never done that again.
Right. It's not worth it. It's funny that you say that, because I started off more in the world of media, like, somebody who's like a, I'm not going to say journalist, but, I would cover films and write about films. This is going back a few years. And I would often take photos of when I was at events and things like that. But the more immersed I got, and as I started my own thing and started to get more and more visible, and I realized that I, you know, once in a while, like we're at this Michael Moore thing, I clicked away some things because it's, but generally it's like, it's not as, I don't feel as comfortable, because then you're coming off as like more of a fan and not as like an industry person.
Yeah, so as I would a colleague, be, yeah.
Yeah, and as a colleague of everybody. So, yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, I was also in no position to be a colleague of hers. Like I was, she for me was actually on a pedestal.
Right.
No, absolutely.
I so, but no, she in was a way, colleague in that project, though.
Yeah, when we were actually in the scenes
together.
Yeah,
I don't
together.
Mean, I heard she might have had a broader movie career, but doesn't. Yeah.
But well, I haven't done that. So, yeah.
She was very good, by the way. Really good. She had a couple of really good scenes in Manglehorn. This is the David Gordon Green film. Did you see it?
No, but I love David Gordon Green.
Yeah, and this was, you know, there's a couple of scenes of her and Pacino that are.
Here are the people I'd love to meet. David Gordon Green.
I can help. He's been on twice.
Spike Jonze. P.T. Anderson.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Jane Campion. Oh, Claire Denis, who's here.
Yeah, she's been on my podcast. You just have to help me with my podcast, and you'll meet all these people eventually, because I'm meeting them all. But Claire Denis was on, and we had a really good time.
Oh, my gosh. No, and actually, I saw Mike Lee maybe three times in the span of 1 hour.
Yeah, I know.
And I was this close. If I didn't have two films that I wanted to make next year in 2015, I was this close from going up to him and saying, Mr. Lee, if there's anything, if you ever want an assistant, I would be happy to volunteer or anything you make. I will do the craft service. Just I'll be around. I'll fly myself anywhere. Yeah.
There, if you look among the panels, there's a panel for that, though, where the filmmakers are lining up and they're just all offering to volunteer on it.
Oh, one day I'll be on that panel.
No, you want to be in the film. I saw him also on the way over here and on the street over on John Street. And I've talked to him before, but this was maybe my 10th time seeing him. And I've seen him like three times also since I got here. And I passed him on the street and he, I had a kind of a smile on my face like, and
he tipped his head.
He did the nod. He didn't smile. He doesn't smile. You know, very rarely.
Yes.
And he shouldn't because he doesn't have a good smile. He's a crusty British filmmaker, you know, but the most talented.
But he did the hello nod.
He did the hello nod.
I see you.
Yes. And he might have read. He thinks. See, there's some weird phenomenon when I almost anybody I meet, they think they've met. They say to me, "You look familiar." Almost everybody. So I actually think is possibility he just assumed that I look familiar to him.
Right.
Because there's this weird phenomenon. I have a face. But
that
the
friendly
bigger thing
face.
Is we have met before. I do have a friendly face, but we have met before because I went up to him the first time. It was with Happy Go Lucky, and they were doing the screening at the New York Film Fest. It was a press screening, and they were in the Walter Reed, and he was in the room adjacent to there just before his press conference. And I had gotten there early. I couldn't go to the screening because I was nuts about Mike Lee and his movies. And so I get there, and I get there early, and it's me and him in the green room. And now, I had recently seen, like, all of his teleplays. Like, you know, like Abigail's Party, all those films.
Yeah.
It was great for. And I was so proud of myself. I said, I'm going to go up to him and tell him I've seen all of his teleplays.
So
I go up there, and he just, like, looked at me and goes, yeah, those transfers are bloody awful. You know, and he's got really
technical.
Angry, like, because the transfers for our, like the UK, in the UK, they had remastered his talk because they look really cruddy. You know, they were basically shot mostly on video, some on film, but most of them were like on video. And
it wasn't holding
they
up.
Looked
yeah.
terrible, and the sound is awful. Like on the American versions, if you rent them. And you can rent them, or you could at one point. I don't know if you could still rent them. I rented them probably on Netflix or something. And I watched them all, you know, as many as I could see. And they're unbelievably good. But he was just got, like, and he just was, like, started to rant about them. And I'm like, oh, great. This was a nice, how do you do? Thank you very much. Now, and then, stupidly, I got to interview him, not for my podcast, but I got to interview him for, like, the Tribeca Film website, I think, when the next film came out, which was a beautiful film. What was it called? Another Year?
Mm-hmm.
Or one of my favorites. And
me too.
And I got him alone at first. I had him, and then I had, like, the cast, or it was a round table with the cast. But this was, again, not for the podcast. So I interviewed him. And what is the first thing I say? You know, we met, and I told you about your... I thought he might find that amusing that I'm reminding him how I pissed him off.
Yes.
No. He just got pissed off all over again. He was But, you know, he's not a good interview because on One-on-One, I mean, that he doesn't suffer fools.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a fool. So I'm hoping for the new film, Mr. Turner, that I have another opportunity and that I'm going to promise myself, bring that up again. Mm-hmm. That is a very, very long anecdote about Mike Lee.
Well, but there can never be too long an anecdote about Mike Lee.
But what amazing filmmaker. Do you remember the first film you saw of his?
Naked.
Really?
Yeah.
That was...
I know.
Incredible.
That was the first film I saw of his, and it blew me away.
Yeah. David Thewlis, right?
Oh.
Incredible performance, right?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
It's interesting, because my first one was what was the one with the two girls? One was had an eating disorder. The two daughters. It was Life is Good.
Oh, I have not even seen Life is Good.
Well, I mean, you know.
So where did that fall? Like Secrets and Lies?
High Hopes and then Life is Good. So
okay,
in other words,
High
I
Hopes.
Think that might have been his second or maybe third feature.
Right.
I didn't know how far back I had been watching his movie.
Right.
Now I'm like, wow, I really did. I was walking by the Quad Cinema in Manhattan. I don't remember. And I think I just said, this looks interesting. And I went in and I was, of course, changed. Came out of there. But Naked also was much... Yeah, as good as Life is Good, I mean, Naked is incredible. And I saw it a couple of times in the theater, and the second time I took friends, and I took two of my female friends, and they brought another female. I think there were like three or four women I was with, and they were all like, oh, it's very misogynist. I'm like, are you kidding? But you're missing the...
Yeah.
Yes, it's a misogynist character.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean the filmmaker is misogynist.
Yeah. I mean, Lars von Trier is misogynist, mm-hmm. but I still really love his films.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite.
Right. Yeah. And
do you not like his work?
I'm not as impassioned when I think of when I watch his movies.
Yeah.
Like I was not as impressed with, you know,
Nymphomania. Okay.
Primarily cuz I think they should have just kept it one film or what have you. But
have you seen both parts?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have not seen part 2.
Oh, well, I saw part 2 on a computer.
Right.
So I saw part 1 in the theater.
Yeah.
But Melancholia.
He keeps pushing. He keeps.
Absolutely.
I
want him in the world.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear him talk, but I want
no,
him in the world.
No, we don't need to hear him talk.
But and also, I mean, the films that I've embraced of his are like in the best films ever. So, you know, when and it's another great example. When the first one came out.
Breaking the Waves.
Breaking the Waves, thank you, came out. Again, blew, like, life-changing.
Oh,
like,
my God, Emily Watson. And Stellan Skarsgård.
And Stellan.
Yeah.
But it was an incredible... I mean, it was, again, one of those films that just changed your way of looking at movies, right?
Changed the conversation.
Right. And then, you know, I found it's so hard to watch because how painful
some
of them are.
Oh, yeah, Dance in the Dark is brutal.
Brutal. That was brutal. I turned it off.
I know.
Doesn't she...
Don't even, because I will start to cry. I actually will.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, we won't. Yeah. And then again, in Melancholia, like I actually had, saw that the New York Film Festival press screening, and I had another screening after.
Mm.
I couldn't go to it.
Yeah.
I couldn't go.
Like, what?
I walked out of Melancholia, and I said, I just need to breathe and recover. And
Requiem for a Dream was like that with me. I remember seeing that at TIFF, and I don't know, I had... another film scheduled after. I was just walking around like a zombie.
Oh, my gosh.
Because sometimes here at the festival, we have these...
Darren Aronofsky's film?
Right, yes. We have these 9:30 a.m. screenings. And the people that make it out to those, because, you know, everyone's been out late the night before, there's a bonding thing that happens. If you make that 9:30 or 8:30 a.m. P&I, and I remember seeing Requiem for a Dream at one of those 8:30 a.m. screenings.
Yeah.
And everyone that was at that screen walked around like a zombie for the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
And it was... I bonded with those people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You, like, experience something together.
Right.
That's why VU... I mean, I don't think cinema will ever die.
No. Didn't Ellen Burstyn break your heart, though?
Oh, she's amazing. I got to work with her also.
What?
Yeah, yeah. I got to work with her. I played a dealer in a prison. It was like this women's prison story.
No TV movie?
Yeah, because, you know, then once I had my dreadlocks, I could only play, like, dealers or prostitutes.
Yeah, I was going to mention that earlier.
I couldn't possibly play, like, a mother or a girlfriend.
Well,
isn't that ridiculous?
That's why you start making your own movies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. But, this was your brand. I hate to say that, but this is you. This is you.
I didn't even, of course, I didn't think of it as a brand. I just, 12 years ago, I shaved my head to play a role of a woman with cancer. So I shaved my head, and then I thought, dreadlocks are on the outside, how I feel on the inside. So I wanted something that was representing some kind of truthful, authentic thing.
Right.
And I didn't know if I would have them forever. I didn't know, but I actually trimmed my locks this summer, and I felt like I cut off my leg. It was that intense. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, you really regret it.
So they were past my butt, and I was swimming in the lake a lot, and so my dreads are like,
heavy.
You know, heavy. I've got about 69 dreads on my head. So when they were past my butt and I would go swimming, they would take like 4 hours to dry and really, really heavy. So I trimmed about 4 inches. And, you know, it's been a couple of months, so I'm getting used
butt.
To it. What's that? They're above. They're above my butt. And I have the little pieces in a bag. So if I had to.
But you know what I've dealt with it.
It's not such a big deal.
Have to extend 4 inches.
No.
I'm just curious to know.
Yeah, extending 4 inches. Well, wouldn't you love that option?
You have no idea. No idea. But mine falls below my butt, too.
Anyway,
yeah.
No, it's fine. But I would say that it's cut me out of the acting world a little bit.
Yeah.
Because
right.
People associate dreads with,
right.
You know.
Anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Not to jump around too much, but before we end our conversation, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about punk films. You have
one thing led to another where in 2012 I got a prize from the Toronto Film Critics Association, the J. Scott Prize, and it came with $5,000. And I was thinking I was going to put that $5,000 into writing my next project, but a lot of my friends here in Toronto, they weren't getting funding for their films, and it was kind of stopping them from moving forward. So instead of putting that $5,000 into my own project, I basically challenged Toronto-based filmmakers. I basically said I would give five filmmakers $1,000 each to make a feature film. Had to be at least 75 minutes, could be a fiction, a doc, or a hybrid. Uh-huh. And all you had to do to apply was to submit your team, a brief idea, and a budget to show me that you could essentially get the film done for $1,000. And I partnered with a distributor, so each film was going to get a screening. And in addition, the distributor was linked to a mixing facility, so each feature film would get a one-day mix, professional mix, with a mixer.
Gratis?
Gratis. Mm-hmm. But you could only spend $1,000 cash making this film. You couldn't contribute any additional funding. And 47 local filmmakers applied to do this thing. We called it the 1K wave. And I chose five. And those five ended up having a great life. So that was sort of a, for some of those filmmakers, it was their first feature film. Mm-hmm. For others, it wasn't. But out of that, I got supercharged. And in fact, I would say that very directly inspired the Animal Project and my wanting to shoot something in Toronto with professional actors. But now that I've done these four features and I've been to many film festivals, I've seen incredible films by women, but I haven't seen those women come back with a second, third, fourth feature film.
Right.
See them making one or two and then disappearing for 5 years. So last fall, I decided to sort of launch something called the Punk Films FemLab, where I wanted to join with five other women, Canadian. So you had to be a woman, you had to be Canadian, and you had to have already had at least one feature film done. Could be doc or fiction. But the lab was about my working with five other women and each of us writing a feature film script that we wanted to direct. Mm-hmm. And we had to fiercely commit to writing that script in 6 months. So we were going to start in January of this year, 2014. And by June, we were going to have six new feature film screenplays complete. No funding for this initiative. 20 women submitted their films to me. I selected five. I joined with them. And in Whistler, at the film festival in December, so just a few months ago in December, I won an award for the Animal Project from the Alliance of Women Film Journalists. So women film journalists were giving me this prize. And at the podium, because I was thinking of the Punk Films FemLab, I said, hey, I want to see more films by women in the world. And everyone was like, yeah, we do too. I said, right. So I'm doing this Punk Films FemLab, which is going to have six of us, six Canadian women, writing six screenplays in the next 6 months. Will anyone step up with $6,000 for a first look at these scripts? Crickets. Nobody. And this is the awards brunch. It's packed with a lot of money is in this room. Okay, is Hollywood Reporter in the house? Yes, they are. Variety's here? Yes. Okay, so whoever stands up is going to get some press out of this. Nobody. Okay, I'm starting to, like, hives are starting to break out on my neck. I'm, like, emotional. I didn't know I was getting this award. I didn't plan this whole thing. I said, all right, I'll just start counting down from six. You have 6 seconds. Anybody? Here we go. Six. Five. Four. And then a woman at the Variety table shot out of her seat, hands in the air, said, I'll do it. And it was Melissa Leo.
Oh, my God.
So Melissa Leo was in the house because, yes, the Academy Award-winning actor for The Fighter was in the house because she was there to present Prisoners, Denis Villeneuve's film.
Right.
So she stood up. She came up to me afterwards and said, okay, so I'm totally down with this. $6,000 is going to be coming to you. I might share it with Jane Fonda. I don't know, but you're going to be getting your check within the week. Sure enough, got a check from her within the week. I selected the five other women. No strings from Melissa Leo. Like, 90% of the people in our motion picture industry would want something in writing, some kind of guarantee for that $6,000, a total act of faith, a total act of, like, yes, no one else is going to stand up in the room. Here we go. Let's get this going. And she followed through, and the six of us followed through, sent off the scripts June 30th, and the first weekend of August, she invited us to her home. We had a slumber party at her place. She gave me her bed. She gave my daughter her camper. We all camped out at her place. She had our scripts before her. She gave us such incredible feedback on the scripts. And I think she's one of the most incredible women in the world.
Well, bring her on the podcast, for God's sake.
Yes, you should have Melissa Leo on the podcast. She's my hero.
Change the name to the Melissa Leo Radio.
Yeah. We should all be writing amazing roles for Melissa Leo because I want to see her in everything. So, anyway, that was just a really happy story, and that's going to be my next feature film.
Okay. Well, that's the
thing
I
wrote.
That it really is a great story.
Yep.
So there's so much more to look forward to in your career. Let's pick up the conversation.
Yeah.
You know,
this time next year,
exactly.
Yeah.
We forgot to mention you're a juror this year.
Yes, I'm on the Canadian Feature Film Jury.
Okay.
Here at TIFF. But if there's, I don't know, if anyone listening wants to connect with me.
Oh, yeah.
There's an email icon on my punk film site, punkfilms.ca. And if you want to connect with me, or if you're passing through Toronto, or if you're making an indie film or anything like that, if you want to just share ideas, let's connect. Let's reach out anytime.
That's great. I appreciate it. Okay, we'll stay in touch better, right?
Yeah.
It's so nice that we've reconnected again. I'm so happy about that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Ingrid. And
my pleasure.
Let's talk soon. So just the other night, I had been invited out to this party and an event for High Maintenance, that web series created by Ben Sinclair and Katja Blickfeld. It's a series of really short movies, if you will, but the common thread throughout is this: at some point during each episode, a pot dealer shows up, right, and delivers his booty, and Ben plays the guy. And who remains nameless. And it's a great series. It can be very funny, very moving. Anyway, there's been a bunch of episodes, and they're releasing the next three shortly. So this was a kind of a preview of that. They showed the first three in this enormous warehouse in Red Hook, and everybody I've ever met was there, and it was pretty great. And I have to say, I'm mentioning it because you can go to Vimeo also, and they're not even sponsoring this episode, but you can go to Vimeo and check out those episodes. As well as all their past episodes of this great web series. And to this day, if you go to episode number 178, it is the most downloaded episode of all my episodes. So we really do need to get them back on. That's the show. Oh yeah. Next episode, finally got Frederick Wiseman on the podcast. Frederick Wiseman, as you know, is the venerable documentary filmmaker, specifically known for making long format documentaries about various institutions around the country, but it's not true because they've also been a bunch of them to have taken place in Europe as well. as is his new film. It's called National Gallery, and it's, of course, shot in the very famous museum in London. But, you know, he goes back from the very beginning. His films have always been greatly received. And his first film, City Cut Follies, was still a landmark film about a institution for, well, you know, like the insane. They just treated their patients so worse than animals. And so it just was a very controversial film when it came out. Then he followed that up with High School, and where he shot in a high school, and he just trains his camera on various scenes and he lets them go. And he's been doing this for for 4 decades now. And more recently, he had a documentary a couple years ago called At Berkeley. And before that, Boxing Gym and Crazy Horse, which was about a burlesque cabaret in Paris. Yeah, just tons and tons of films. And you got to see it. There's still too many to name, quite frankly. But I caught up to a few more, including Domestic Violence and La Danse. So anyway, Frederick Wiseman on the podcast next episode. So please tune back in. Thank you for listening, everybody. This is your host, Adam Chartoff. The name of the show is Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time.